On the 11th of November 2012, my father, who was aged 88, passed away. At the time, I was 48 years old. And, of course, I was very sad. And it was ironic that my dad, who served for 7 years in the British Army between 1942 and 1949, should pass away on Remembrance Sunday. If you recall from previous podcasts, it was my dad that got me fascinated into the subject of the Great War, when one of my earliest memories was, as a young lad, 7 or 8 years old, watching my dad stand up and salute at the ceremony on Remembrance Sunday in Whitehall. And when I asked him why he was doing that, he said that he was remembering our uncle, my great uncle Henry, that had died on the Somme. And it was that memory many decades later that got me interested in this fascinating subject. But why should I remember my dad today? Because it's out of gratitude, really. Because for 48 years, he was there for me. An old-fashioned man, he left, as most dads did in those days, the actual upbringing of me to my mum. But Dad was always there. I knew he was there. He was there when I needed advice. He was there at my wedding. He was there on important birthdays. He was there when I needed advice on such crucial matters. And probably the most important advice he gave me was when I was thinking at the age of 30 of moving out of the corporate world and setting up a small business of my own. I'll never forget what he said. He said, if you're going to do it now. If you leave it until you're older, you won't be able to do it. I now realise how important that advice was. Dad was always there whenever I needed him. And he defines me as a person, and I'm sure many of you feel that about your dads. And this week's episode I've called Children of the Fallen, because whilst I'm so grateful that I had my dad for nearly half a century of my life, and he's still there in my thoughts every day, I can still hear his voice. Did you know that about 360,000 children lost their dads in the Great War? And many of them, whose dads did return, they didn't recognise them. Their dads had gone off to war, perhaps when they were too young to remember. And when they came back, they, of course, were suffering from physical and the mental impacts of the horrors of the trenches, or the war in the air, or the war at sea. I've read many accounts of children looking at their dads just to see a silent stare looking back at them. Thoughts that weren't really there. Thoughts were with their mates that they'd left behind and the horrors that they had personally experienced. This is a fascinating subject, so I thought it was time that we looked at the stories of those young people, how they dealt with the impact in later life of not having that father figure that I was so fortunate to have. And we also look in detail about the moments that they discovered that their dad wasn't coming back. And as we know, of course, so many of those children were perhaps too young to understand, but suddenly, in a moment, they became an adult. There was no social services. There was a war pension, perhaps, which didn't really help. It didn't last for too long. Suddenly, these young people had to support their mums. They had to go out to work. Their lives changed forever. And as we'll see, for many of them, they were to follow in their father's footsteps a generation later, when the Second World War came around. What happened to them? Well, we're going to find out this week. Now, as usual, I've used a number of different sources to discover these stories. But the main resource I've used comes from a man called Richard Van Emden, if you remember. He came on the podcast some time ago, talked about boy soldiers, and I'm hoping to get Richard on at some stage to talk about Harry Patch as well, because he wrote his biography and became friends with Harry, Harry being the last fighting Tommy. But this book that I'm talking about this week, Richard called The Quick and the Dead, He talks about the fallen soldiers and the impact on their families in the Great War. And he says that there was a 9-year-old girl called Ellen Elston, and she nearly forgot that she had a dad, and she'd only seen him once between the time he left with his regiment for France until the time of his death in 1917. That was nearly 2 years. And in old age, Ellen gave an interview to the BBC, and we can listen to her voice now as she looked back on what happened when her dad died in the Great War.
In 1917, just before my 9th birthday, a messenger came on a bicycle, because in those days, I suppose, it was a telegram boy with like a pillbox hat, all red, and brought a telegram to say, I think it just said, killed in action. The shock sort of stopped our life for a little while, you know, really. In the sitting room, Mum had this great big picture on the wall of Dad in his uniform, head and shoulders, and she just turned it round the other way, probably because it upset her to see it every time she went in the room, you see. Mum had to go out to work to earn some money. So at 9 years old, I was left with the family to look after. I had a brother, a year younger than me, and there were three girls younger than him, and then a young baby, very young, who was... He used to worry me a lot because he cried. You couldn't show any emotion because of the younger children. So I used to sort of go to bed and cry my eyes out, cry myself to sleep.
I don't know about you, but I find it really difficult listening to that. I've heard it several times now, and I feel extremely emotional hearing her voice. She lived all of her life, nearly all of her life, without her dad. She talks about being 9 years old, and as I listened to that, I thought back to when I was 9, and I can remember that my dad had a job which took him all over the country, and I used to lie in bed worrying about him driving back in the dark late at night, and I can remember not being able to go to sleep until I heard the door open and then close again, and knowing that Dad was home and safe. There was no telegram to come to our house. Dad always came home. Ellen, she didn't have the good fortune that I had. In Richard Videndum's book, The Quick and the Dead, he's got some more details about what Ellen said about her experiences then. She said, "It may sound funny, but my father's death meant a new dress to me. Ellen's mother quickly made her daughter's black and white check dresses with a black belt to wear while outside. Ellen was aware of the sympathetic look she received from local people for a man well known in the area, but she said, I don't think Dad's death registered somehow because he was buried out there." She goes on to say, "You're upset for your mother, really. You're upset because your mother is upset. I could hear her wandering around the house crying, although she tried to put a brave face on it in front of the children. Yes, I remember crying and crying for my mother, not because my father was killed." Ellen goes on to say that after his death, his brother became a monk and he came round to the house to visit, but his mother gave him short shrift. She says, "My mother ordered him out of the house. I can remember that quite plainly. And she said to him, 'Please don't come telling me there's a God because I don't believe in him anymore.'" In 2008, the BBC produced a documentary which they called What Did You Do in the Great War, Daddy? And it's a documentary that I've watched over and over again. And one of the people that was featured in this documentary was a man called Donald Overall, who Richard Van Emden had interviewed for his book, and who in 2007 accompanied Donald to the grave of his father that was killed in June 1917 while serving with the 6th Battalion of the London Regiment, the City of London Rifles, and is buried in Qu'Essel Railway Cemetery. It must have been an incredible moment for Donald and, of course, Richard that was with him and the film crew. At that stage, Donald was 98 years old himself, and he'd lived his entire life almost without having his father by his side. And in the Second World War, Donald, like so many of them, joined up to help in the fight against Germany. He was in the Royal Air Force. He was a flight engineer in a Halifax bomber. And during 1944 and 1945, he took part in many bombing expeditions across occupied France and then into Germany. And as he flew across northern France, he said he'd stared down into the night's inky blackness and thought of his father down there. And he made a promise to himself that one day he would visit his dad. And when he did eventually make that journey at that old age of 98, this is what he said. He said, "I'm an old man. I'm supposed to be tough. I thought I was hard, but I'm not. He's my dad. I miss him. I missed him as a boy, and I miss him as an old man. It's very important that I've come back. Can you understand? I feel closer now than I ever have been. That time he carried me to bed was the last time, and this is the next time, 90 years. I don't know how much longer I will live, but I will never forget him. I would have come here. I wouldn't have cared if it was snowing, because it meant something." Donald had crystal clear memories of the day that the postman came and knocked on the door. It was a knock on the door that changed his life forever. Donald was at home with his mother when the news came. He said, "I remember the day we heard very distinctly. We lived just off the old Kent Road, which was a row of terraced houses, each divided into three flats, and we rented the middle flat. Mother and I were downstairs in the main hall when the doorbell rang. I was hiding behind her as she was handed an envelope. I remember she opened the letter immediately. I didn't know what it said, but she screamed and collapsed on the floor in a dead faint. I tried to wake her up. I didn't know what was wrong. I was holding on to her skirts and called out for help, and an elderly couple who lived in a lower flat came out and comforted both of us. Mother came round slowly, and they eventually got her upstairs into the bedroom. She was there for about 10 days, and it was while she was getting better that she turned onto her side and she said to me, 'Your father's dead. He won't come back. Now you are the man of the house. You must do things as best you can.' And I said to me, Mum, I was 5 years old. That changed my life. It had to. I had to stand up and be counted. And I did stand up straight. And I've always stood up to be counted." Donald mentioned there his father carrying him upstairs to bed. Don't forget, he was just 5 years old. He had another memory of his father that wasn't to do with a sight or sound. It was to do with smell. He said he was in his army uniform, this is when he came back on leave, and I could smell his khaki and tobacco because he smoked a pipe. I then remember my father carrying me upstairs on his left shoulder. My head was against his face, and I can remember seeing his ears and smelling his jacket and his tobacco. But of course, as his mum told him, he had to help now, and that involved jobs around the house. He said, "Even as a five-year-old, I used to peel the spuds, cut up the onions, stick a fork in the sausages, and when time permitted, my mother and I would make blackberry and apple jam. There were more tiring jobs, I had to clean the stair rods because our flat was the first flight up, and to buff up the brass fender with a metal polish. And lastly, I had to go and do the shopping. I had a wicker basket with a big handle which I put over my arms, and Mum used to write the list of goods to be brought and precise money to pay for each of them, and I'd go round to the old Kent Road, aged no more than six. The shopkeepers used to treat us kids quite well. I wasn't the only one who'd lost a father. And then one day a policeman came round on a pushbike with a blue helmet blowing a whistle, and he was shouting, "Air raid! Take cover!" I was standing there and I looked up and I saw all the Gotha bombers with their swept-back wings coming along the old Kent Road towards London, quite a number of them. I was frightened and I didn't know what to do. But a man came along and said, "Where are you going, son?" So I told him, and he put a dustbin lid over my head and steered me across the road, and I walked home with my shopping basket with goods in my hands and a dustbin lid held over my head. Little did he know at this stage that 20 years or so later, it would be him that would be in a bomber. And in this case, he'd be flying over occupied France and then into Germany. And I remember in that documentary, Donald talking about attending the cenotaph on the 11th of November 1920, the day that the cenotaph was unveiled. And he said he was there with his mother and his younger brother, who was called Cyril. He said, "We got there quite early and got quite close to the cenotaph. We saw all the proceedings. Nobody dared move. Nobody wanted to move. My mother stood there with her arms round us two kids, and she cried. And I just stood there dumbfounded. The congregation consisted of ex-servicemen, widows and orphans, fathers and mothers. The organ was playing with a regimental band in accompaniment, and the one hymn they played was O Valiant Hearts. And my mother was in tears once more, and I can't forget that day. I was feeling for my mum, and I'd never had to confront those feelings before." Now, for this next story, we look at the 1911 census, and we find Harry and his wife, Nellie Jones, living at number 8 Inkerman Terrace in Northampton, a street that's no longer there. And they'd got two children, Emily, who was 9 years old, and young Arthur, who was just 7 months. And like so many people in Northampton at the time, Harry, who was 29 years old in 1911, was working in the boot and shoe trade as a shoe finisher. And when the First World War came around, 3 years later, he joined up. Did Harry, and he found himself in the 2nd 5th Battalion of the Manchester Regiment. And in August of 1917, the regiment, or the battalion that he was in, was holding the line on the most northern part of the Western Front at a place called Nieuport. They were literally digging and holding the line on the beaches there. And at times there was savage fighting there as the Germans tried to break through there. And Harry must have been involved in some of the horrific exchanges that took place there in that summer of 1917. Because he was wounded. I've got his pension card in front of me, which I found on the Western Front Association website, and it tells us that he wasn't wounded by bullets or by shrapnel or by those shrapnel balls. No, it tells us that he was wounded by liquid fire, flamethrowers. But he wasn't killed at that stage. He didn't die. Somehow he was evacuated back home. But then in what must have been awful circumstances, the effects of that liquid fire, the effects of the burns on his skin, meant that he lost his life on the 31st of August of 1917, and he was buried in a World War I plot within the Toaster Road Cemetery in Northampton. And because he died at home, it meant that Nellie, his widow, was able to attend his funeral, no doubt. And before he died, before he was wounded, Harry must have been home on leave, because at the time he died, at the time that Nellie attended his funeral at Toaster Road, she was carrying a third child, Harry, and he was born in January of 1918, but he never knew his father because his father had died, 5 months before he was born. The eldest son, Arthur, that we mentioned, he'd been born in 1910, so he'd have been, 7 years old at this stage when he lost his father. I wonder whether he could remember much about him. So Nellie chose the words that were inscribed on his headstone. She said, "He laid the richest of all gifts on the altar of duty, his life." Now, she went on with her life and she got married again and became Nellie Freeman. And the 1921 census tells us that her new husband, Ernest Freeman, had one daughter of his own, but he welcomed into the family the three children, including Arthur, who in 1921 was 10 years old. And then what happens a generation later, what they feared most of all, is a second Great War, the Second World War. And Arthur finds himself serving at the beginning of the war in the 2nd Battalion of the Grenadier Guards. He's now 29 years old, and that battalion of the Grenadier Guards are over in France in May of 1940 when the Germans commence their blitzkrieg on the Western Front. They storm through France and Holland and Belgium. They converge on the retreating British Expeditionary Force as they try to escape the ruthless German army. And they're heading for Dunkirk, and Arthur Jones is amongst them. The 2nd Battalion of the Grenadier Guards, they're one of those units that are chosen to try and hold the perimeter so that the majority of the BEF and the French soldiers that were alongside them could be evacuated in that Operation Dynamo, as it was codenamed. And that meant that they were to encounter the full wrath of the much larger and skilled and armoured German army. The Germans were determined to annihilate the 220,000 or so British soldiers that were still in France. They were going to either capture them or kill them. Arthur Jones was amongst their number. And they retreated. Of course they did. They all did. And in those last few days of May, the Grenadier Guards found themselves with Arthur holding one side of a canal, which they hope would form a natural barrier between them and the advancing Germans. They had to hold the line there. This is a place called Furness. Not sure if I've pronounced that right. Of course, it's in Belgium, just on the Belgian side of the border with France, Furnes. And I wonder whether he knew that he was just 5 miles away from where 23 years earlier his father had suffered those dreadful wounds from the flamethrower attack. I wonder if he knew that. Probably didn't. But he was just 5 miles away from where his father received his mortal wounds in a previous war. There was Arthur, now in mortal danger himself from the same enemy, the Germans. Now, I went down to Kew, the National Archives in Kew, to copy the Battalion War Diary for the 2nd Grenadier Guards. These records have not yet been digitised. And it's quite nice in a way, though, to actually open a box and find a paper copy of something. It's not the same, isn't it, when you look at a digitised record, but to actually hold in your hands the records, historical records, is for me, it's some kind of thrill. And there it was, neatly typed up, the Battalion Diary. I'm going to take you through what happened in those last few days near Dunkirk at Furness. He said the outskirts of Furness were reached without any casualties. There was considerable shelling in the town itself and soon very considerable SA, small arms fire. Captain Harrison reported back to Major Colvin that the enemy had broken through and had already reached the line of the canal. They also discovered that two officers, Major Pakenham and Captain Jeffries, had been killed. The importance of keeping out of sight of the enemy was stressed, and companies had orders to fortify houses and stay in them by day and night. The only movement allowed in the street was to be company runners and linesmen. The centre and left companies had considerable difficulty in occupying their positions, being under fire from both 5th Columnists on the rear bank of the canal and German snipers on the far bank. So 5th Columnists were traitors, really, working from within a country, in this case Belgium, but actually fighting for the enemy, fighting for the Germans. Must have come as quite a shock, mustn't it, to the men when they realised that they were being fired at from their side of the canal, from people that they thought were friends. It says the battalion headquarters had been established in a cellar in the centre of the town, but the cellar had been occupied by a 5th Columnist. They found him and they executed him. Summary justice, that is, isn't it? This is a bit of a disgrace, what it says then. It says the whole occupation of the town and the loss of life to the battalion could have been avoided if the British troops holding the town on the previous day had not been drunk when the battalion entered it, as were a great proportion of the French soldiers. I've not read that before. Easy to make judgments of this situation, what, 85 years later, but these men were scared. They thought they were going to be killed or captured. I suppose the natural thing is to take advantage of whatever they could, and soldiers often turn to alcohol. That's what they did. Throughout the night, it says there was general enemy activity on the front and the shelling was slight. By 1100 hours on the 30th, there was every evidence of a strong enemy attack on a battalion front, and heavy shellfire commenced over the whole town, as well as aerial bombing. There were few casualties owing to the excellence of the cellars and no movement in the streets. At about 11:30 a.m. an attempt was made by the Germans to cross the canal, but it was easily frustrated. It tells us that the enemy were using rubber boats, which sunk when they were hit by bursts of small arms fire. During the afternoon, the shelling continued unabated, and there were two tremendous explosions which shook the whole town and brought down all damaged buildings. These were thought to be either aerial torpedoes, or listen to this, liquid air bombs. Now, I've not heard of that before, liquid air bombs. But there was young Arthur. His position, perhaps, was being attacked with these liquid air bombs. Had he been wounded by one of those, he would have encountered the same injuries that his father had suffered all those years before. Again, I wonder whether he was aware of that. Many houses in the town were burning fiercely, and the situation was, the diary says, unpleasant. That must be putting it mildly, isn't it? More and more German artillery was being brought up to close range. The position remained very obscure for some hours, there being fierce fighting on the canal bank. A meeting of the senior command then decided that they were to evacuate their positions, get back to the beaches and embark for England. All kit other than Bren guns, rifles, were to be abandoned. The Bren guns and the rifles would be taken to England. And the final withdrawal from Furness was to be made as quickly as possible. At 2:25 hours, company commanders briefed the men. And the diary says this is the first occasion on which the other ranks of the battalion were informed of the intention to embark for England. Further attempts were made by the enemy to cross the canal throughout the whole morning, and the shell fire was very heavy. The battalion, of course, was picking up more and more casualties. At 12:20 hours, it was discovered that the Germans had broken through. They were crossing the canal unopposed. Once again, they managed to stabilise the situation. It doesn't say how. This is another horrific entry in the diary. Second Lieutenant Jones, who's no relation to the family that we're talking about, with the remaining two sections of the platoon, was sent to investigate the line being broken. He said he returned at 1400 hours and reported that the position had been stabilised. But when he arrived, he'd found that the Royal Berkshires and Royal Suffolk regiments, accompanied by men of a field company of Royal Engineers who had been put in the line, were about to withdraw without orders. An effort was made by one of their officers to rally them, but they broke under heavy enemy shellfire before they could be reorganised. It's this next bit. Mr. Jones found it necessary to shoot some of the men and his NCOs turned officers at the point of the bayonet. He succeeded in restoring order, and he himself led the remains of both of these battalions. The Royal Engineers went back to the line of the canal. It was reported that those two battalions had no capable officer present with either battalion, and that communication with their own HQ was non-existent, and they had very little ammunition left. No wonder that those men were looking to leave their positions. But of course, it was so important for those hundreds of thousands of others that the line was held at all costs. Again, I'm not making any judgment on that situation. You can if you want, but I don't see how you can judge it when it happened so long ago and we weren't there, were we? Said it a number of times in this diary as we're going through it. The position was stabilised. It says the morale of the men was high. All wounded men had been evacuated. All wounded men had been evacuated. That's important. The remainder of the day was spent without further enemy attack, but shelling continued. The town was now in ruins and burning fiercely. The next day was the 1st of June, 1940. Now getting to the stage where the final evacuations are taking place. They found themselves on the sands at Dunkirk. They were heavily shelled towards the end of the march there. They spent a comfortable time, it says, on the sand dunes, watching the beaches being machine gunned and bombed. And they saw two destroyers and two transports sunk by dive bombers. At 2:30 in the afternoon on the 1st of June, they and their entire division went along the beach to the mole at Dunkirk. The weather was very hot, it says, and eventually they managed to get on a boat. They travelled at high speed, it says, towards Dover and arrived after a very good and quiet crossing. And they were in the port at Dover at 6:30 in the morning on the 2nd. We had to wait there for some hours. They were then put on trains, moved off to Borden. They had a very generous meal pushed at them through the windows at Tonbridge. They were showered with food, drink and cigarettes at every halt and were greeted at Penge in South London by the Salvation Army Band. We got to Borden at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And they were taken off to a camp where the men were given tea, bathed and put into tents. Now, Arthur was one of those that had been wounded in the retreat, but they managed to evacuate him with the rest of the battalion back to the UK. But very sadly, he wasn't amongst those that saw the Salvation Army Band that was showered with food, drink and cigarettes on the 2nd. Because during the crossing on the 1st, he died of wounds. His body was returned to his mum in Northampton. And with incredible irony, found himself being buried literally yards or metres away from his father Harry that had died 23 years earlier. Nellie, his mum, she'd have been there. Once again, she had the job of choosing the words for the family inscription on the headstones. She chose these words: "He laid the richest of all gifts on the altar of duty, his life." You might have heard those words before. They're exactly the same words that she'd chosen for Harry when she stood in that same plot, the same cemetery, the same feelings, no doubt. Well, how did I discover this story? As I usually do with so many of these, going through the local newspaper archives in Northampton in the library. There was an article in June of 1940. It simply said, in the headlines, "Both die of wounds. Father in the last war, son in this." Says the death in hospital of wounds received in action with the BEF is reported of Lance Corporal Arthur Jones of 150 London Road in Northampton. He was a meter reader and collector in the employment of the Northampton Electric Light and Power Company Limited. And prior to the outbreak of the war, Jones, who was an army reservist, and was mobilised at the outset of the war, and he went to France in October. His father died of wounds received in action in the Great War. What it doesn't say in that article is the two coincidences that we've talked about here. Well, the first one was a coincidence anyway, that they were both mortally wounded 23 years apart, but only 5 miles apart. But now they lie not far from each other in the Toaster Road Cemetery. Arthur, a child of a casualty in horrific circumstances from the First World War, he himself dies in the Second World War. Just imagine how Nellie, now remarried, must have felt on that day in June of 1940 when she buried Arthur so close to her first husband. It was so sad for these young children to wave goodbye to their dad, probably not really understanding what the Great War was all about or where they were going, but they knew that Daddy was going away. Just listen to how this woman felt as she recalls the experience of her father leaving the home and going off to war.
Oh, it was terrible days, terrible days. My father said to my mother, "Oh, I've got to go. My group is called up and I've got to go. I've got to go tomorrow." And of course, she was very, very upset. And us two children were, oh, well, the end of the world had come for us with Daddy gone.
That was Ruth Armstrong, born in 1906. I came across this poem recently on Facebook. It doesn't have a name to it, but just listen to these words. "I march beneath the crimson sky, unsure if I would live or die. A letter home clutched in my pack, dreaming of the day I'd come back. The mud was cold, the nights were long, yet in my chest a steadfast song. For love of home, for fields of green, I fought for peace I'd never see." Outside the home of Hull Rugby League Club, there is a memorial that was unveiled in 2017 to mark the centenary of one of their most famous sons being awarded the Victoria Cross. But he was awarded it posthumously because in the action that he carried out his brave attempt to capture a German machine gun, he lost his life. He was a teacher in civilian life, and in early May 1917, during the Battle of Arras, there was a heavy machine gun fire causing multiple casualties on advancing soldiers of the East Yorkshire Regiment. And it was Jack that decided he was going to do something about it. He stood up and runs towards Oppy Wood, where the machine gun was firing from, and he silenced the gun by blowing it up, but then he's seen to fall. With the firing finally lifting, a number of his comrades manage to get into the enemy-held strong point in that wood, but they're pushed back, and they end up back in their own trenches from where they'd set out from several hours before. And the cost to the battalion that day, which started with 800 men, included 12 officers and 215 men who'd been killed. And one of those was Second Lieutenant John Jack Harrison. He'd been a star, really, for Hull Rugby League Club. It was his hometown. Played his first game for the club in September 1912, and he was a winger when the club won the Challenge Cup in 1913-14 season, and he scored a try in the final. And in that season, he actually scored 52 tries, and that's a club record that still stands to this day. And he played 116 games for Hull, and in those 116 games, he scored an incredible 106 tries, and his last game for them was on Boxing Day of 1916. And then he joined up the Hull Powers of the East Yorkshire Regiment. He was awarded the Military Cross after leading a patrol in No Man's Land. The citation read, "Second Lieutenant John Harrison, for conspicuous gallantry and devotion to duty, he handled his platoon with great courage and skill. He reached his objective under the most trying conditions and captured a prisoner. He led a splendid example throughout." And his citation for his posthumous Victoria Cross reads like this: "For most conspicuous bravery and self-sacrifice in an attack, owing to darkness and to smoke from the enemy barrage and from our own barrage, and to the fact that our objective was in a dark wood, it was impossible to see when our barrage had lifted off the enemy front line. Nevertheless, Second Lieutenant Harrison led his company against the enemy trench under every rifle and machine gun fire, but was repulsed. Reorganising his command as best he could in no man's land, he again attacked in darkness under terrific fire, but with no success. Then, turning round, this gallant officer, single-handed, made a dash at the machine gun, hoping to knock out the gun and so save the lives of many of his company. His self-sacrifice and absolute disregard of danger was an inspiring example to all. He is reported missing, believed killed. Doesn't have a grave, does Jack Harrison, John Harrison, Jack was his nickname. And he's remembered on the Arras Memorial to the Missing. So why do I include this story? Well, I'll tell you why. Because Jack had married Lillian on the 1st of September 1914. And on the 29th of June 1915, they welcomed a son, also called John, into the family. And that means that when Jack Sr. died in action at Arras in 1917, his young son had not yet reached his second birthday. But I'll tell you what his son did. He followed in his father's footsteps. He joined the army in the Second World War. He joined the Duke of Wellington's, the West Riding Regiment. He became a captain. And he too found himself on those beaches of Dunkirk in late May of 1940, on the 1st of June 1940. So, just like Arthur Jones, Captain John Harrison died 23 years after his father. His body was buried by the locals and he's now buried in the Dunkirk Town Cemetery. It was King George V that presented the Victoria Cross to Lillian on the 2nd of March 1918, and when she died, she left his Victoria Cross to the East Yorkshire Regimental Museum in Beverley, but they're now held at the Yorkshire Museum in the City of York, and it's the Prince of Wales Regimental Museum which is housed within that museum itself. If you go to the National Memorial Arboretum in Staffordshire, you'll find a memorial there to the men that were shot at dawn during the First World War. It was opened in May of 2001 by Her Royal Highness the Duchess of Kent. But one of the people that was there was the daughter of one of those men that was shot at dawn in the First World War. And her name is Mrs. Gertrude Harris. Her father was Private Harry Farr, who'd fought at the Battle of Neuve Chapelle in 1915 and during the Battle of the Somme in 1916. But on four separate occasions during this period, in 1915 and 1916, he'd reported sick with his nerves, what we would now call shell shock. He'd spent 5 months in hospital, but he returned to action with the West Yorkshire Regiment. But in September of 1916, he was court-martialed after he refused to go back to the trenches. But he said he couldn't stand the noise of the artillery. And he was found guilty of misbehaving before the enemy in such a manner as to show cowardice. Unfortunately, having been executed at the age of 25. His grave was lost. And if you go to the Tietvel Memorial, you'll find his name registered there. Now, the purpose of this story, it's our final story today, is not to discuss the merits of whether Harry should or should not have been executed, but to highlight the work carried out by his daughter. She was 93 years old when, after a long campaign, she managed to get a pardon, not just for her father, but a blanket pardon for those men that were shot at dawn. Let's listen now to what happened when news came through to her mother that Harry had been shot at dawn, and how her mother managed to ensure that her young daughter, Gertrude, knew nothing about the circumstances. And when this happened, Gertrude was just 2 years old.
On Armistice Day, my mother always had to watch the procession and the laying of the wreaths. And when she used to see the old veterans walking along, she said, "My Harry should have been there with them. He should have been up there to be honoured for what he did for his country." My mother had a letter from the War Office, and in it it just said, "We wish to inform you that your husband was shot for cowardice on the 18th of October, 1916. And that was all that she had, nothing else. And she said she had a blouse on at the moment, and she pushed the letter down in her blouse, and she never told anyone.
The next voice you'll hear is a recording in 1993. It's Harry's wife, his widow herself, that tells us how she felt.
"I didn't want nobody to know what happened. I thought it was so terrible. I felt it was so awful. I felt it was on my shoulders, all that stigma. That's how I felt. And even my dear mother didn't know, nor his mother. Not till the time came when my pension was stopped. Then I had to tell them, because they wanted to know why I was looking so ill and how upset I was. And I had to tell them."
Daughter Gertrude then continues the story and explains the shame that the family had to put up with.
"Well, she was living in her lodgings. The landlady said, 'Well, I'm awfully sorry, Gertrude, but you'll just have to go.' And we were virtually homeless. We were turned out into the street, and she was advised to go to the Soldiers and Sailors Association. And they said, 'Well, first of all, the child will have to go into a home.' So Mother said, 'No, that I'll never do. You've taken my husband, but you're not taking my child. I'm going to keep her with me.' Soon after Mother had had her letter from the War Office, she said she had the vicar from her local church in North Kensington, and he had been asked by the chaplain who was at the execution of my father, and he said, 'Will you tell his wife he was no coward? He wouldn't even had a blindfold.' And she always said that a finer soldier never lived. And I think they were the words that she carried to her grave."
Gertrude, Harry's daughter, was 40 years old before her mother told her what had actually happened. When news of the pardon came through, Gertrude said, "I'm so relieved that this ordeal is now over and I can be content knowing that my father's memory is intact. I've always argued that my father's refusal to rejoin the front line, described in the court-martial as resulting from cowardice, was in fact the result of shell shock, and I believe that many other soldiers suffer from this, not just my father. So I thought that it would be important to end the story not about a child from the First World War that subsequently died in tragic circumstances, but about someone who did something about what had happened to her father, who, in her view and the view of many others, righted a wrong, a travesty of justice. As she said, she left this world knowing that she'd done something so important, not just for her dad, but for her mum as well." And we end the podcast this week with another delve into Richard Van Endem's book that I mentioned at the beginning of today's episode, The Quick and the Dead. Right at the beginning of the book, he talks about a fisherman called Steve Gowan that was hauling in his catch of cod in the Thames estuary. He noticed an old ginger beer bottle in his fishing nets, and inside it there was a piece of paper. He prized off the rubber stopper that sealed the bottle, and to his amazement he found inside a message that had been written by a soldier as he was about to leave for war in September of 1914, and this is what it said. "Dear wife, I'm writing this note on this boat and dropping it into the sea just to see if it will reach you. If it does, sign this envelope on the right-hand bottom corner where it says receipt. Put the date and hour of receipt and your name where it says signature and look after it well. The message ends, ta-ta, sweet, for the present, your hubby." The writer asked the finder to kindly forward the enclosed letter and earn the blessing of a poor British soldier on his way to the front. Now, that letter was discovered by Steve Gowan in 1999, but just 13 days after Thomas Hughes had written it, he was killed in action. His widow was called Elizabeth, and she was left with a two-year-old daughter. She went on to remarry, and in 1919, after the war, she emigrated from her home in Stockton-on-Tees, which is in the northeast of England, all the way round to the other side of the world, to New Zealand. And in 1999, when this story became news, it appeared in the British newspaper The Times. And they discovered that that two-year-old daughter was called Emily. She was still alive. So Steve, who found the letter, went all the way to Auckland and handed it to her, and she was 86 years old. Steve told The Times, "Thomas Hughes had sailed from Southampton, so the bottle had bumped along the seafloor, carried along by the tides and currents for over 100 miles to reach the estuary. It had got to the stage where one edge was really thin and it would not have been long before it would have been broken." He's talking about the bottle. 2 years after that, at the age of 88, incredibly, Emily made her one and only trip back to Britain to meet relatives that she'd never known, and she gave that bottle to the Durham Light Infantry Museum for safekeeping. Now, a few weeks ago, we did the podcast called Love Broken by War, and in that I told the story of a man called Frank Woods who'd been jilted by his fiancée and then many years later took his own life by throwing himself off a railway bridge on the edge of Northampton. A very strange thing happened to me yesterday. I was on a train coming from London Euston back to Northampton, and as we often do, don't we, when we're on a train, I dozed off. And then, I suppose, in the back of my mind, I knew, even though I was asleep, that we were approaching Northampton. And I woke up, and I woke up with a start. I sort of jumped, really. And when I looked out of the window, I recognised where I was. We were passing below that bridge where Frank Woods chose to end his life in 1959. And do you remember that man, Donald Overall, had been to see his father's grave late in life? We said that in the Second World War, he was in the RAF. By this time, he was the father of two sons himself. And he was on a Halifax bomber. And he said that the closest he came to death, on one occasion returning to the airfield, the pilot hit the ground heavily, throwing the Halifax back into the air. As it did so, the plane turned at an acute angle so that the starboard wing nearly touched the ground. But eventually, they managed to land the plane safely. And Donald says if that wing had touched the ground, it would have ripped off, igniting the petrol fumes inside. In this situation, the flames would have come straight through the plane where I was standing and fried me alive. In that critical moment, it flashed through my mind that my wife would have had a sergeant's pension on which to live with my two boys. You have to understand that all this went through my mind in an instant before the plane was brought under control. Then the reaction set in and I was frightened and the sweat came out of every pore of my body and I could hardly keep my hands still for a few seconds. Nobody spoke about the incidents afterwards. We just got on with our job. Yet I was racked with the knowledge that I'd come perilously close to leaving my sons at roughly the same age as when my father had died and left my brother Cecil and me. He then goes on to say that at the end of the war, he thought about signing off with the RAF for another 4 years, but didn't want to, that he still felt like a civilian that was in an Air Force uniform. So he went home and he talked to his wife, who was called Ada. And when he'd finished explaining the situation, Ada said to him, "Well, love, the two boys need their father." "How could I answer that," says Donald, "when I never had a father? I couldn't sign on for another 4 years. I would have loved to, but the kids come first, don't they?" I think that's a fitting end to the podcast, don't you? Once again, we end as we started, with me thinking about my dad and how fortunate I was to have him there for well over half of my life, to think about the wonderful life that he had. So many of his generation didn't have such a wonderful life. Normally we'd end the podcast by the playing of the last post. I wanted to do something slightly different this week. There's a song called Father and Son, sang by Cat Stevens. The lyrics of that are quite special. So I thought we'd end this week by listening to that song.
It's not time to make a change. Just relax, take it easy. You're still young, that's your fault. There's so much you have to know. Find a girl, settle down. If you want, you can marry. Look at me, I am old, but I'm happy. Like you are now, and I know that it's not easy to be calm when you found something going on. But take your time, think a lot. Why, think of everything you've got, for you will still be here tomorrow, but your dreams may not. To explain, when I do, he turns away again. It's always been the same, same old story. From the moment I could talk, I was ordered to listen. Now there's a way, and I know that I have to go away. I know I have to go. Change, just sit down, take it slowly. You're still young, that's your fault. There's so much you have to go through. Find a girl, settle down. If you want, you can marry. Look at me, I am old, but I'm happy. All the times that I've cried, keeping all the things I knew inside. It's hard, but it's harder to ignore it. If they were right, I'd agree, but it's them they know, not me. Now there's a way, and I know that I have to go away. away. I know I have to go.